All right. Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome to the next episode of SCI TV. Today, we're joined by Shane Fisher, a former Team USA athlete and a founder of American Paragon Foundation. Shane, it's a pleasure to meet you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on, and I am very excited to talk.
Yeah. Well, first and foremost, I want to hear about your experience with Team USA, right? You've been a bobsled athlete for how many years, remind me?
4 years now.
4 years now. Wow. And what was your experience there, and to what it is you're doing right now? What's the connection?
So my experience of bobsled was kind of like a wild journey that I never expected to happen in the first place, because my entire junior athletic career was a tennis player. I played tennis in college, and then I transitioned to track and field, and with the goal was always to get to the Olympics in some capacity. And I trained track and field professionally for 6 years. And then a random opportunity appeared for me to be able to try out for the United States bobsled team. I tried out, and then a couple of weeks later, I was on a plane to Lake Placid, New York. And
wow.
I was just sort of looking around going, oh man, I'm closer now to my goal than I've ever been. And so I decided, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to focus on bobsled. And I'd always been interested in bobsled as a kid. You know, you watch Cool Runnings and you watch it at the Olympics and everything. And it's a very cool sport. It's one of the cool sports in the world, honestly. And but I had never planned on it. And bobsled is not really the type of sport where people plan on being a bobsledder. It's something you sort of like wind up in. And my experience on Team USA led me to found the American Paragons Foundation, because as I got closer and closer to my goal of the Olympics, and I started meeting more of these incredible athletes from all these different sports and spending time at the Olympic Training Center, I started seeing problems and difficulties that everybody was facing. And it was a pattern. There were a lot of very similar things. Everybody's got their own story, of course, but there are definitely patterns in terms of financial hardships, employment hardships, like media visibility hardships. Like, there are very similar things happening. And I looked around to look for support systems and outside organizations that could potentially alleviate this. And it didn't really exist. And so I said, all right, well, if it's going to change and we're going to make a quality change, it's only going to happen grassroots, and it's only going to happen if an athlete leaves it. And so that's what I did. And I started the American Paragons Foundation, and it's been incredible ever since.
Wow, that's amazing. So first of all, are you saying that I can also become a U.S., not a U.S., but an Olympic athlete? You said you started after college. That just gave me some hopes right
Depends
there.
On how fast you run.
I don't run, no.
Yeah, so maybe not. Maybe something else. Maybe archery or air rifle marksmanship.
Okay, sounds good. But I'll let you know when I step on my archery path.
Yeah.
And then maybe you can represent me, and I can be part of
the
foundation.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah, then I'll have you in the foundation.
Well, very, very interesting. Well, I'm curious to learn more about your experience, right? I feel like not many people get to be a part of, Team USA in any sport, but your journey has been so, so different. And being a part of such high performance environments, right? People often tie their identity to their role. And I'm just curious to hear your experience with that, coming from different sports before and then, exiting the sport and now running the foundation. Was it difficult trying to, tie that identity that you have to all of those different hats that you wear as a professional and then as an athlete?
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot to unpack, but there's a lot of aspects to that. I mean, I've always been an advocate for watering as many different plants in your life as possible. I learned pretty early on in my life by watching some of my tennis playing friends who were extremely good at tennis. When they were losing, their mental health was crumbling, and when they were winning, they were on top of the world. And you learn pretty quickly how dangerous it is to tie your entire identity into one thing. I think that's something that many elite athletes struggle with, because most of the time, if you get to the level of Team USA or this level of sport, you've been good at it your whole life. You know, like, you don't just like magically show up one day and then you're good at it. And so a lot of people have been praising you throughout your life for this one specific thing, right? Like, you continually win ski races, or you continually win tennis matches, or what it is. And then when you don't have that anymore, you kind of feel lost because you don't really know who you are. I've always made a conscious effort to try and separate other parts of myself and water other plants that are in my life, so that all of my identity is not entirely dependent on sports performance. And I've seen a lot of people at this level struggle to do that, which is reasonable, but it's dangerous. And I consider myself really lucky. And I think that this is the number one thing that allowed me to transition into this founder role, because I was able to take all of the lessons of grit and determination and cleverness and whatever other crafty nature that I need to have to be successful in athletics, and then transition them to something that's not athletics and still feel like I am being fulfilled. And because a lot of people very much will struggle to feel fulfilled if it's not in the thing that they're being praised for earlier. So if you can remember that you are a full human being and you are not just a performance machine, then I think it's easier to take those skills and those things that you've learned and live a happy life doing something else. But it's something that most people at the highest levels struggle to do.
Yeah, no, great points. And, you know, as you said, the point about the performance machine and some expectations, do you feel like people in high performance environments, sports teams, or even outside, actually feel, you know, safe to speak up? I think personally, from like what I've read and from my experiences, you know, sometimes tension comes from, you know, unclear rules and expectations that are being placed on athletes. So what do you have to say on that?
I think that it's really difficult to navigate in the first place, like, because the expectation and the better you get at doing something, expectations will fall on your shoulders, right? Like, if you prove time and time again that you are excellent at doing something, people are going to expect that you continually are excellent at doing that thing. And it becomes very difficult to like mentally separate yourself from that and to be able to be okay with failure or setback or other things like that. But, and I think that it extends beyond sports. I think that everything, if you're a high performing salesperson and then you have a bad quarter, everyone starts looking at you and saying, like, well, aren't you the one who's supposed to be so good at this? Or if you're a successful founder and you run into some roadblocks, either like with a issue that happens or something, people are looking at you. And I think you have to be able to hold yourself accountable for the level that you want to like expect from yourself. But we also need to give ourselves enough grace to be able to not crumble. Because I think if you don't give yourself that grace and you don't allow yourself to crumble, and you lean into the identity that you are accidentally sort of creating or that other people have placed upon you, you become brittle. And if when you inevitably break under that pressure, you're going to shatter under the pressure, and it's going to be very, very detrimental to your career. So I think you have to be a little more flexible and be more kind to yourself. That would be like my number one piece of advice for anyone who's been high performing, is you have to be kind to yourself.
Let's take this a step further. So I did my research a few years ago on how NIL, so name, image, and likeness, affects team trust and team cohesion for collegiate football. And essentially what we found was that, you know, NIL and some of the financial discrepancies that have, like, you know, that happen between players, where we have someone making, you know, six figures, seven figures, eight figures, versus, you know, another member of the team is only getting a scooter for the season. Like, those differences in opportunities really do affect team trust and team cohesion and just locker room dynamics and on the field dynamics. I'm curious to hear how does that, and how could that apply to, you know, Olympic athletes? Because essentially what we're talking about here is that only the top 1 or 2% of Olympic athletes actually have the reputation and the brand contracts and, you know, the ability to grow their personal brand. But what about the rest of those people?
Yeah, it is extremely relevant to Olympic sport, specifically because it is the type of sport that doesn't have billions and billions of dollars at an NGB level. So at a high level, there absolutely is a significant amount of money flowing. But the way that the structure works within the United States is we have the USOPC, which is like the governing, like, federal body of Olympic sport. And then we have NGBs, which stands for National Governing Body. So we have a national governing body for every sport in the Olympics. Yeah. We have like USA archery, USA diving, USA swimming, USA track and field, all those other things. And it's designed that way because each sport is unique and they need to have their own qualifications, they have their own coaches, they have their own everything. So it does make sense, but it also segregates a lot of resources and a lot of like systems. And some NGBs are more talented at fundraising than other NGBs, just at like an organizational level. And it causes a lot of friction on the athlete side, because if you only have enough money to really throw enough support behind one or two people, but you have a team of 15 people, those 13 like losers that don't get chosen to get those resources are going to be extremely resentful. And you're also talking about, you know, this sort of vicious cycle of, if you go to the Olympics, you maybe are going to be the person who's chosen to get all of those resources in the next cycle. But if you're one of the people who are not getting the resources, now you can't go to the Olympics. And so it becomes like a self-fulfilling prophecy of who will and will not be successful. And that is very difficult for the NGBs to navigate, because they're trying to remain objective and they're trying to like get out of litigation, and they don't want, like, they want to avoid conflict in the first place rather than resolve conflict. And it sometimes leads to no one really getting the support that they need, because if they can't launch a program that's equitable to all of the athletes that are under the umbrella of the NGB, they prefer to launch no program. And then everybody ends up kind of like thrown to the wolves, and everybody's unhappy, but it's the only conceivable way to move forward without like getting litigated at every single Olympics.
Yeah. Would you say that continued education on the, you know, NGB level is something that is needed when it comes to, you know, the dynamics with the athletes themselves, and how can we help set them up for the future? Because as you said, those Olympic spots are limited, and how can we really help the other athletes, you know, navigate through that ambiguity?
I think that it's a very difficult thing, and that it's one of the things that the NGB system is good for, in that like there are some teams that have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of athletes that are fighting for a couple spots, and they don't have a consistent roster. So for example, USA Track and Field, there's no roster of USA Track and Field. Like, we all know who Noah Lyles is because he's the Olympic champion, but Noah Lyles has to qualify for every World Championships or international event on his own. There's no like, oh, our 100 team is Noah Lyles and XYZ other people. If someone were to show up and beat Noah Lyles, they would just have his spot forever. And then there are other teams that have an assigned roster. So let's say USA Rugby, right? Like, they will bring these people together, and there is a roster of USA Rugby athletes. Unless you are in one of those rostered sports, it's really difficult to pull off. So I think that's one of the reasons that my foundation like shines is that I don't care what position you're in your NGB. I don't care if you're the currently winning. I don't care if you're on the development team. I provide these continuing education resources and these support resources to everyone in a completely equitable way. And my nonprofit has no decision-making capability whatsoever within anyone's NGBs or anybody's system. So if I am able to give out resources, no one can accuse my nonprofit of like, you know, stacking an Olympic team because I don't choose the Olympic teams. So I think that I have a unique opportunity through the American Paragons Foundation to provide a lot of that continuing education and those support sources that mm-hmm. they absolutely must have.
Yeah. Let's touch a little bit on women's sports and specifically, you know, at a college level. I feel like the NIL landscape has been changing so much in the last few years. And there is a lot of conversation between, you know, revenue sports and non-revenue sports. And I know you advocate a lot for women's sports. I'm just curious to hear what you think, you know, about the new volleyball league being established, some of the WNBA success, and what it is we're seeing and the incredible growth of women's sports, and how can they position themselves, you know, as a leader when it comes to, you know, the some of the athletic departments.
So, I mean, there's both on an NCAA level and a beyond level, but I mean, people want to watch women's sports. I mean, it's one of those things where it's pretty obvious at this point that the demand is there and that the lack of demand was almost manufactured because the WNBA is blowing up at a pretty ridiculous level because they got the investment and it was, if you build it, they will come. And previously they did not build it. And that's why no one came. I mean, obviously women's tennis is incredibly popular worldwide. Women's golf is very popular. Like, people want to watch women's sport, and there is opportunity for women's sport for both the athletes and the organizations to make a lot of money. I think as we are entering this new kind of Wild West NIL landscape, we need to be having some protections for women's sports within the non-revenue generating side, because I mean there are a lot of non-revenue generating men's sports as well, and Title IX needs to sort of protect the women's sports a lot more. I think that in my opinion, if I could wave a magic wand, I would say that any college, any NCAA institution should be allowed to give as much money as they want to their revenue generating athletes, but out of the gross money that is allocated towards NIL, 30% of it needs to be allocated to non-revenue generating sports. So you can make that number as high or as low as you want. If you want to pay your football players $3 billion, feel free, but the women's diving team is going to get paid too, right? And like, it's unreasonable to say, okay, the women's diving team is also going to get $3 billion. Like, we have to be reasonable at a certain point. I would much rather see women getting paid to participate in college sports so that we have that platform to move on into professional sports in at least some capacity than having the colleges just cut the programs in general. Because I mean, that's what we're seeing is a lot of these, I mean, like Oregon's cutting a bunch of their track stuff. A lot of colleges are cutting men's and women's sports, but I mean, women's sports are gonna be on the chopping block first, which is not fair. And I think that they need to have a little of that protection.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely still a lot of things to figure out, right? It's relatively new, as you said. It's a wild, wild west. But what I am very curious about is, you know, the athletes themselves, right? Before, they were primarily student athletes, and it was such a different playing field. But now it's, I believe there's such a high level of cognitive load and just burnout among these people, because not only do they have to be good students and have good academic standing and perform well on their team, but it's all now tied to contracts and endorsements and personal branding. And it's very challenging, I feel like, for the whole system, for coaches, for students, for athletic directors to really navigate that additional aspect that just came into college sports. And it's no longer about just being a good student and, you know, a good athlete. You have to have that, you know, online presence and the brand presence and everything that is, you know, attributed to you as an individual. And you know, I wonder where that's going to take those young people, because I cannot imagine how they do it. I personally feel like it's a lot to handle.
You can see it, I mean, changing already. And there needs to be some protections. I frankly think that the like, I don't know if it was an EO or something. Like, it's hard to tell with what's going on with the administration about transfer limitations and things like that. We need it, like, because otherwise no one's going to get educated. No one's going to get any amount of a real education, and it becomes impossible to create team culture. It creates impossible to create cohesion. It's impossible to create trust on the team, that the people aren't just going to run the moment you have a bad, you know, like you lose two or three games in a row, and then like your three-star players just say, "I'm in the portal, see ya." And it's also disincentivizing a lot of the athletes themselves to take their education seriously, because if you are, you know, making $500,000 per year for these 4 years, it's like, it is life-changing money. And if you're incentivized to always be looking at the next thing, right? Like, can I get into the portal? Can I get a better deal? Can I do all of this? What are my expectations when I get to that school for the marketing and for, you know, like the merchandise and all of those other things? It's going to take your attention away from academics. Like, there's no way that that can't take your attention away from academics. And you can't even be mad at the athletes for chasing the incentives, because you put those incentives in front of them, that's more money than they've ever conceived of 6 months ago, right? So there needs to be some sort of reins to keep this from being as crazy as it currently is. Otherwise, we're doing a disservice to the athletes by not giving them an education. And we're also making college sports less fun, because it's not as, you know, why are you cheering for your team that hard when it's like a different person every couple months? You know, like, it used to be like, this is a guy that you see in math class, and then you get to go in Friday Night Lights style and go scream and yell and tailgate and everything. And now it's like, there's a new person coming in every couple mm-hmm. weeks. It feels like that it's impossible to create that like crowd and fan like loyalty that frankly they need to have.
Absolutely. Would you say that, in your opinion, the root of conflict among, you know, the kids that play those team sports is like rooted deeply in the culture and what's happening, perhaps, you know, as you said, the transfer portal and maybe misaligned incentives and, you know, some of the financial opportunities and inequalities there?
Yeah, I mean, it all comes down to money. At the end of the day, it's always money. I mean, like, there were issues and there were transfers and there were things before they could get paid for NIL. So, I mean, it's not like that's the root of every single thing. Like, there will always be conflict. And but it's also hard to say, because, you know, prior to the NIL, there was still money. It just wasn't in the hands of the athletes, right? Mm-hmm. So you could argue that, you know, money might still be the genesis of it even before, but people are going to act in the ways that they're incentivized to act, right? And if there's $500,000, $1 million, multiple millions of dollars on the line, it's impossible to ask an 18-year-old kid to act like reasonably and to like think of the fan experience or to think of legacy or to think of any of those things. Like, the kid's going to go get the bread. Like, and that's all there is to it. So yeah, I mean, it's the money. At the end of the day, it's the money. And so that's why you also at a certain point have to start reining it in with some sort of legislation, because otherwise it's just going to be professional sports too, electric boogaloo. Like,
yeah, no, I agree. And I think it's in my last question. I love what we were discussing here. I think it's so important. What do you think governing bodies, you know, universities and just other institutions need to do to really support young athletes before they go you know, pro, and even when they do out after they're, you know, done with their collegiate education?
I think the most important thing that could change that would make a significant difference is eliminating the like faux classes that we all know exist, you know, like these classes that a lot of, you know, football players or basketball players are enrolled in that are academically not rigorous whatsoever, that are designed to allow these student athletes to kind of coast their way through college. We're doing them a disservice in that way. Like if we cannot design college sports in a way that allows the student athletes to get an education and to get paid, then we don't deserve to have college sports. And that should be the end of the discussion, right? So if you are only able to make your program run by having like bogus classes and pushing people through that don't deserve to get this education, then you shouldn't be running a program. I think that has downstream effects, because if you're giving that athlete a large amount of money and they're not getting academically challenged in any way, when you put that person in like a financial literacy class, or you're trying to give them guidance on, hey, here's how you, when you leave this place and you're going and negotiating contracts, or you're getting an agent, or you're doing all these other things and you're moving on to the next level, here's how you don't get taken advantage of, they're not paying attention. Because you incentivize them to not, like every time they sit down in a chair and somebody is speaking to them, they can zone out because they're going to get pushed through the system regardless. And then when they zone out during that unbelievably important conversation or series of conversations, then they move on to the next level and they get taken advantage of. They lose all their money, right? They end up having like a pretty horrible like fall from grace. And it's at the core, it's the university's fault for creating that environment prior to those conversations happening.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's why we hear so many stories about, you know, current athletes that are, you know, playing pro sports right now, trying to get out of some of the contracts that they have signed when they were, you know, in high school, and they didn't have enough education and enough guidance when it comes to where am I putting my signature on and like what am I committing to and for how many years. So yeah, to your point, I think continued education and education in college is crucial. And at the end of the day, I feel like everyone is going to benefit if we really, you know, put a lot of impact onto the education field.
There's absolutely no downside to having more educated citizens, like no matter what their job is. I don't care if they're engineers or doctors or athletes or musicians, the more educated we can be and the stronger we will be as a society. And at the end of the day, it's up to the universities to make sure that every one of those students is getting that education.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Shane, thank you so much for joining us today. I greatly enjoyed this conversation, and I'm sure our listeners will too. We wish you the best of luck with the American Paragons Foundation, and we're really looking forward to see how you grow, and we're going to be supporting your journey. And thank you so much for being part of SCI TV.
Perfect. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you.